Welcome to Trillions. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchunas.
Eric, are you ready for next year yet?
Absolutely.
I am so over 2020. How about 2021? Can we get there?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, this year has felt like a decade.
Like longer than a decade.
Yes. I mean,
and there's been so many phases to it.
Somebody brought up something that happened in January, and it seemed like 100 miles
away. The before times?
Yeah.
The before times.
Yeah, the before.
I think longingly about the before times.
Yeah, BC.
But on this episode of Trillions, we're going to go into the future.
Kind
of,
yeah.
We're going to talk about the future.
Yeah, you know, last year and every half year, we kind of do these outlooks, and that term gets, you know, it's a little beaten down and trite at this point. And we do an outlook. But we thought for this audience, given this sort of retailish nature, we would do what we're calling 21 in 21. So we're going to go over 21 ETFs that we're watching in this coming year. And just to be clear, we do not give investment advice. So this is not ETFs we think will go up or down. It's ones that we as analysts just keep thinking about and we're fascinated by, and they kind of tap into some bigger themes and topics. And so basically we had the whole team, and the team being myself, Athanasia Serafagas, James Seifert, and Morgan Barna, each pick 5 ETFs. And then we all sort of agreed on the 21st, which we'll go over at the end. But that's the general idea, and we'll go through it during this podcast.
This time on Trillions, 21 ETFs for 2021. Okay, so we're going in from youngest to oldest, which means James Seifert is on the hot seat to go first. James, what's your opening batch of ETF tickers for 2021?
So my opening batch actually breaks the rules. It's not technically an ETF. It's GBTC.
You're already not following instructions.
Correct.
Years off to a terrible start.
But this is something you can't leave off, especially in the environment we're in. It's the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust. So it holds Bitcoin. It's not technically an ETF. It's what's known as a grantor trust. Basically, it operates kind of like a closed-end fund. It's not the most efficient vehicle in the world. But right now, Bitcoin's sitting near all-time highs, just shy of 20,000. The fund itself has a market cap of around 14 billion, which is nothing to sneeze at for sure. It's taken in a lot of money this year. It would be in the top 50 for getting flows this year in 2020. So looking to see if this continues into 2021. The other side of this that brings up is a Bitcoin ETF. This is something that's been talked about since 2017, possibly even earlier when the Winklevoss first filed. And it's just the SEC is not letting it happen. There's kind of a disservice, in my opinion, going on here with the SEC allowing this product to operate in the OTC markets where retail investors can buy it, but they can't buy a more efficient actual ETF that holds Bitcoin. So what you have right now, this thing on Friday closed at roughly a 30% premium to its underlying value. So basically, you're paying a 30% premium just to get access to this fund that holds Bitcoin. So there's a bunch of issues here, but this is the best product you have inside the current existing brokerage system. So just going to see how this goes. And the other thing I'm watching is if a Bitcoin ETF does get approved, I think there's a good chance that this product actually gets converted to an ETF. So it'll open up at the door at a $10 billion product if it converts from a grantor trust to an ETF.
Okay. Number two?
Number two is a little more boring. It's VXUS, the Vanguard Total International Stock ETF. If you look at like global equity landscape and you slice it, the common way to slice it in three ways, right? So you're looking at domestic equity, international developed, and then emerging market. If you look at the domestic equity market right now, I mean, over the last 10 years, domestic stocks have outperformed international stocks by 190%, with emerging markets doing slightly worse and international developed doing slightly better. But it's been an absolute dominant run by domestic. So I'm watching this to see if international stocks can do some catching up. The other thing I'm watching is VXUS has been around for about 10 years, has only seen 3 days of outflows. It's just a perpetual parade of inflows, partially because of that underperformance. So people are constantly rebalancing into this. So if that changes, I want to see if this thing starts seeing outflows.
Number three.
I'm going to go with SNPE here, which is the Xtrackers S&P 500 ESG ETF. Obviously, ESG is a hot topic. It has been for a couple of years. We're finally starting to see assets go to the space. The other thing here is I like these types of products. They find them more interesting. When I mean these types of products, S&PE is an exclusionary portfolio. So what it does is it gives you the S&P 500 and basically takes out the worst actors from each sector and then a couple of other ones like tobacco and weapons. So you're getting broadly the S&P 500, but just kind of taking things off the edge that it thinks are the worst performers. And the other thing I'm looking at here is there's three other ETFs that track the same exact index. One on the US market, which is E5 from Spider. And then there's one from Invesco in Europe, which is SPXE, and one in Canada that's ESG. So all of these have about just shy of $1 billion. So I want to see how quickly those assets grow because S&P is obviously pushing this as a product.
How do they decide what gets excluded? Is it just performance?
It's actually a pretty complicated methodology. Depending on the sector, it takes certain scores into more importance. So like they might take social more important in this area, or like obviously energy, they take into carbon a little more seriously. So different things get different weighted. So the whole idea is just like based on your sector, we're going to get rid of the worst things from that sector. And we're just going to give you the goal is to give a risk return characteristic similar to the S&P 500, which we've done tons of research. We've talked about it on this podcast. The things that are most like beta, the most like what you can put in a core portfolio, tend to get the most assets and interest from advisors.
Okay. Number four.
So I'm going to go with OVL, which is the Overlay Shares Large Cap Equity ETF. There's another one, SPYC from Simplify, the Simplify US Equity Plus Convexity ETF. These are structured product ETFs. They have like kind of overlays, and it's an interesting market for these. There's a couple of them coming to market. We've talked about the buffer products on here a bunch. We had Bruce Bond on. All of these kind of like option strategy ETFs are coming to market. It's a booming area, and it's a good time for it right now with interest rates so low. There's a lot of people looking for yield replacement. There's a lot of people saying that you can't just do a 60-40 portfolio, so they're taking a little away from each side and going to these other types of products. Some of them, OVL, for instance, has outperformed since its launch, so I'm just kind of watching to see both the performance of these things and how well they do at gathering assets. So we'll see.
And your fifth and final.
So my fifth and final is TQQQ, and also SQQQ. TQQQ is the triple levered long Qs or NASDAQ 100 ETF. This thing has shocked us this year. It is the fourth most traded ETF on U.S. exchanges in 2020 so far, which is kind of insane for me to think about that a triple leverage product would do it. But that kind of is indicative of two things. One, Robinhood traders, we'll just use that term, but really retail traders on any platform have ballooned during the pandemic. And also, obviously, tech has done extremely well. The Qs have outperformed the S&P 500 over a long period of time. And the Qs have even outperformed by more. The TQQQ has outperformed by more because basically the way it's leveraged, if it's a consistent ride up, it actually will generate more return than the underlying investment. So basically going to be watching to see two things. One, does this outperformance continue? And two, does this amount of trading, I mean, this thing trades almost $4 billion a day. So is that going to slow down when things start opening up? There's sports back on TV now, more gambling, more things like that. Are people going to leave the trading arena from their desks at home? So all that's going to be interesting rots in 2021, in my view.
Hey, Eric, I don't know if you were listening to this, but James picked a ticker that wasn't an ETF, and then he picked two tickers instead of one. What do you have to say about him and his picks?
I think it's on brand. I think, look, James is like, when I want to know like the mindset of a millennial day trader, I ask James. He's got Bitcoin, he's got triple leverage Qs, and he's got ESG in there. And then some, you know, option overlay. I think they're great. I think all of these are really interesting. I think VXUS is the one that's a little unexpected from his picks. That said, you know, waiting for international to catch up or do, you know, to have a good run has been something that's been like a 5-year story. But our chief market strategist, Gina Martin Adams, has talked about look out for some rotations next year. And one of those is to international. So I think they're great. I think they're all indicative of things that are going to play out next year. I think Bitcoin ETF, if you have Biden pick somebody who is just the right person at the SEC, potentially you could see one approve quickly. But I'm still doubtful.
I'll add something. And on the Bitcoin thing that I think is really interesting, they want to prove it. Europe has Bitcoin ETFs already, right? And they're performing pretty well. So it's interesting that you have all these approvals in Europe, and there's multiple Bitcoin ETFs. So I'd have to think that the SEC is looking over in Europe. You know, usually it's the other way around. Europe's looking to what the US is doing, but it seems like this time they're looking the other way. So I think depending how some of these products trade could hopefully open the door and make it a little bit easier for Bitcoin approval in the US.
Yeah, and there's a lot of whataboutism with some of the stuff that Robinhood people are doing. And then they're like, but there still isn't a Bitcoin ETF. You know, we looked, a Bitcoin ETF ranked by volatility wouldn't even be in the top 50. There would be, you know, dozens of ETPs that are more volatile than a Bitcoin fund would be. It just comes down to that, you know, surveillance on exchanges and the possibility of manipulation that the SEC can't seem to get over. But and look, you know, over in Sweden, they'd launched this stuff a long time ago. There's the one over there is 5 years old, and there has not been really much problem with the premium discount. It seemed to do the job exactly as an ETP should. I'm surprised they haven't looked at that and said, okay, well, it's worked there 5 years. Let's give it a shot. But they're obsessed with the underlying market more than how the product will work. And that's the issue.
All right. Second youngest analyst, Morgan, number six ETF for 2021.
ICBT, iShares Convertible Bond ETF. So the convertibles market have really ballooned this year. There was sort of a bulge year. We're on track for like 117 billion of issuance. This fund tracks the Bloomberg Barclays U.S. Convertible Cash Pay Bond Index, which is really issuers coming to market for, you know, really appealing borrow rates with an equity conversion option. So the appreciation investors see really is linked to the equity growth. But just the nature of the issuers has been super interesting this year. Entrants that were more distressed, like American Airlines, Royal Caribbean, but also just really fast-growing companies that are looking to, you know, lower their cost of borrowing, companies like Shopify and NovaCure. So ultimately, with the conversion option, investors in this fund have seen really strong growth, like 53% up this year. For investors who really want to stick to a certain bond allocation, this is kind of an interesting play to do it. Some of the mutual funds have loads, so I like that the ETF is clean share class, and this fund actually only charges 20 bips.
Okay. Number seven.
I'm going with QQQJ, which we've
I don't know
about
that one. I know Qs, but I don't know QQQJ.
Yeah, relatively new. Launched in October. It was an extension of sort of the NASDAQ brand by Invesco, which is really interesting. It's the next 100 listed companies on the NASDAQ that are non-financials. So in line with the QQQ brand. Obviously that brand has had some pretty big strides this year, just in notoriety and investors' interest in it. But this next 100, actually, we like that it overlaps with a number of sort of hot thematic categories, even just looking at the top three holdings. I mean, 5G, content streaming, on-demand internet, ad tech, you know, this is just sort of intersects with a lot of interesting themes. So we're watching this fund. We think it's going to get more traction. The coming year, it already has $355 million in assets.
Okay. Number eight?
I chose KMED, Crane Shares Emerging Markets Healthcare ETF. This is a smaller fund, but we've seen, as some have described, a bit of a K recovery. I think, you know, healthcare, along with biotech, but really, you know, healthcare and emerging markets has been part of the upper leg of that K. They're just some really interesting exposure here among some of the more innovative emerging markets economies. This fund has a 30% allocation in China, 22% South Korea, 13% Hong Kong, and 13% India. So really those stronger growing emerging market economies right now. The structural, I guess, play here is that healthcare costs as a share of GDP is supposed to grow a lot faster in emerging markets than developed. Just the demographic tailwind there coming along with urbanization. So the fund has seen some really strong growing names this year, but I think it owes to the construction of it. So it's market cap weighted with a cap at 4.5%. And then anything over that is distributed pro rata at the rest of the holdings. So it does feature some higher weightings in smaller companies. And yeah, I'm watching this one next year. I think the demographic trends are going to continue to play out.
Okay, number nine.
I chose BATT, B-A-T-T, which is Amplifies Lithium and Battery Technology.
I was going to say, if this has nothing to do with battery, it would be like the weirdest ticker of all time. But okay.
Yeah.
Glad to know it's battery.
This is a battery ETF. Actually, super interestingly, this fund converted from an actively managed to an index-based strategy in mid-October. So that's part of why I'm watching it, because I think the index-based construction is really going to change the investment mandate change too. I think this fund is going to have a little bit of a different trajectory going forward. So they actually notched down their exposure to lithium miners by 10%. The fund added 16% energy storage makers, and now it's including EV auto manufacturers in a meaningful way. It's going to try to contain those automakers to just 20% of the exposure and get more of the end-to-end battery life cycle and still keep the miners in there. But you know, it's added Tesla, NIO, like a bunch of these EV makers, though the EV maker has to have 90% top line revenue from electric vehicles. But interestingly, the other automakers, as they you know, maybe naturally increase their EV output, could be considered for this fund. So I think the construction is interesting. They even have like sort of a market cap minimum for some of the lithium miners and other metals producers. So they have to have a reasonable share of the market. I think it just tries to edge really close to this, the sector and the growth in lithium ion battery demand.
Okay. And your 10th?
my fifth and the 10th pick is NETL, Fundamental Income Net Lease REIT ETF. This is an interesting sub-segment of the single tenant REIT index in the US. So this is an index product, but it's sort of a sub-index of only those REITs that operate with triple net leases. So the managers actually have a much better path through of rental income to investors. So these tend to be, this is a higher yielding segment. Right now it's around 4.4%. Just as a starting point, the BI single tenant REIT index has done 15% better than the broader North American REIT index. I think that proves some defensibility on the single tenant side. And I see that kind of that defensibility kind of continuing next year, this being a little bit more of a shielded segment of the real estate operators. But I think there's really interesting embedded portfolio diversity. This is sort of a big range of tenant types. And for real estate or a yield sleeve, this is an interesting strategy.
Eric, what do you think about her picks for 2021?
No, they're great. They're all kind of out of the box stuff I hadn't really thought of. The only one that the whole team was on was QQQJ. I think this product came out. Rarely a product gets launched and you're like, God, that makes so much sense. Like, I'm surprised they didn't do that one sooner. You know, the next 100 in the queues. I suppose that the queues were so on fire this year that it just, the idea was more natural than the years past, but that's a good one. I like the EM themes. Our analyst, Gaurav, for BI, who covers all the emerging markets, he's written naturally about themes, even though ETFs are not his coverage, and they naturally connect with some of the things that the issuers have been doing with try to unbundle EM a little bit to try to capture the more growthy areas and cut out the stuff that doesn't grow that fast. And then the battery, you know, lithium has LIT, the competing one, has $1.3 billion, which is way more than I thought it did. And then the electric driving car ETFs, there's like three of them now. They also have about $500 million. So there's clearly interest in that one. So I also thought that was good. And also IVCT, I rarely even think about convertibles. And it's the best performing fixed income ETF of the year at 50%, which again was a shocker. So I enjoy being surprised by the picks. And I was surprised by like four of these five.
Yeah, I mean, the ICVT pick is the one that jumped out at me just because when she said it and I looked it up, I was like, that chart is impressive to look at. And it's definitely a unique way, as she mentioned, to get like your fixed income exposure. I talked about using those overlay structured product strategies as kind of like a way to change your 60-40 portfolio. Maybe you take a little from each and put in those. And I think ICVT also kind of fits into that theme because you get a little more of the equity upside, but there's a little more principal protection on the downside, theoretically. Because it does have a fixed income floor. So I think ICVT also fits into that theme that I spoke about pretty well.
I like the QQ, QJ pick as well. And I like it from the angle that it's a mid-cap focus. You know, MDUI, which is like the mid-cap ETF, is like one of the best performing ETFs of all time. And it's traditionally been an area that NASDAQ just frankly hasn't focused on. So they it's pretty interesting that they found that gap and now they're able to compete in the mid-cap space as well.
Sarah Fagus, keep the mic. Let's hear what you got for 2021.
All right. My picks aren't as hardcore millennial because I grew up in the analog world too a little bit. So I've seen them both. But the first one I'll start with is a SPGP. It's the Invesco S&P 500 GARP ETF. GARP standing for growth at a reasonable price. But the way I explain this one, it's like growth light. You're seeing this transition over to value now. Value's been doing really well. You've seen it come up more and more. But if there's one thing that history has taught us, it's that anyone who keeps allocating to value gets burned. What GARP does is it still doesn't allow you to let go of these growth companies, but it downshifts a little bit. So if I was to run a chart between growth, value, and GARP, I'd fall somewhere in the middle. So why I like this one is that it's still playing on this transition out of growth into value, but it's not fully moving over. Sometimes you see this binary move. People move out of growth right into value. This one just sort of downshifts a little bit. It's a really small product. It's not that well known, but the other thing I found interesting is that the issuer actually changed their strategy. It used to be like a full-on growth strategy, and they changed it to GARP. So even themselves are inherently making a market call. And, you know, they're being a little bit more watered down growth. So I think this is a really interesting one to watch for next year.
Number 12?
Number 12 is iBuy, which is the Amplify Online Retail ETF. Now, I don't need to sell you on the story of online retail and how well that's doing, but why I like this one, and I call it sort of the non-Amazon ETF. So when you look at a lot of these consumer discretionary or online retail product, they are dominated by Amazon. Usually anywhere from 15 to 20% of the product is Amazon. This only has a 2% weight to Amazon because it's equal weighted. And even with that, the ETF is up over 100% this year, which is like the fifth best performing ETF out there. I like this product because it comes from a smaller issuer from Amplify. It's capitalizing on the online retail trend, but it's not Amazon. So there's all these other names. There's so much happening in the ecosystem outside of Amazon. A lot of people forget that. And this product brings all these smaller companies to light. And as you can see, they're all performing really well because most of this performance has been outside of the Amazon story.
What are some other holdings that you like in there?
Yeah, so like Roku is a big one that comes up, Garmin. So there's all these other companies that are still capitalizing off this online retail trend. But Amazon's like the 20 or something or so biggest holding. So that's why I really like it. It really takes the focus off of Amazon.
Okay, number 13.
This is my millennial pick. It's the SPAC ETF, the Defiance Next Gen SPAC Derive ETF. Now, this one is still really small. It's only got a few million in it, and it just launched. But this one seems to check a lot of the boxes for these thematic ETFs that do really well. It had interest right out of the gate. It started trading very heavily. You know, it's capitalizing on this Robinhood investor base that's looking more and more in thematic. SPACs obviously have had a fantastic year. There's something 70 billion or so raised through SPACs this year, which is a record. So the SPAC one, it checks all the boxes that it should do well. I'm actually a little bit surprised that it's smaller than it really is, but I'd be on the lookout next year because it's the only ETF out there to play SPACs in any way, unless you're buying the specific SPACs themselves. So this one's more of my shocking pick that I thought this one would be a lot bigger. And also just given how strong thematics have been this year, pretty much any thematic ETF that's come to the market has done really well this year very early on. So I'm a little bit surprised that there's not more bites on this SPAC ETF yet.
Okay, 14?
14 is a classic. It's USMV, which is the iShares MinVol ETF. And why I brought this one back in is because if you look at flows this year, it's the first year ever that low vol is going to have outflows. And I think it's more of this FOMO, right? Low vol tends to do well in down markets and tends to lag on the way up. And why I thought it was interesting, because given how volatile the market was this year, especially in March, these tend to take in assets, but they've really been bleeding pretty significantly. And if you had bought low vol this year, you're actually lagging the S&P by 12%, which I think is a really significant amount to get this on people's radar. So given what we've seen with the Fed jumping in and really having the markets back, I don't see a lot of interest in USMV. I think a lot of people want to go into the high beta stuff. So you're seeing investors move out of low vol. And it's interesting because it's every year it's been taking in money. It's been good for a couple billion every year for some of these issuers. But this year has been a complete reversal of what historically we've seen with min vol.
Okay. And your final.
Okay. The last one is a active non-transparent ETF, or ANTS as we're coining it. The ticker is FDG, which is the American Century Focused Dynamic Growth ETF. It's a long name, but this one is really my bellwether for ANTS and how well ANTS are going to do. They're really new, right? And the whole point of ANTS was that these active funds can now launch and not have to show their holdings daily. So the holdings are a little bit lagged. But the performance of this has been really good. It's already beating its benchmark by 26%. It only launched this year. It has about $200 million in assets. Now, we debate this on the team that, you know, some are more bullish on ANTS than others. But I think this one is, if there's one that has a chance of the group, this is going to be the best one, I think. I think it's the most interesting strategy. It holds names like Tesla. This one is really going to be, I think, my bellwether to see how well people are accepting of these new ETFs.
Hey, Morgan, how come you didn't pick his SPAC pick? Why did you pass on that?
You know, I like the pick. I think it's really interesting. We'll have to see, I mean, based on sort of the market cap weighting in these, like, you know, how they really play out. This is kind of the second go. I think SPAC's got a bad name early on, but I think, you know, the diversity of managers, you know, listing and the expediency to which they can bring things public. This might be a better round than the first. So.
Yeah, and the SPAC ETF, the one thing that you have to point out is that it's only 20% pre-IPO SPACs. Those are where you get the big pop. So 80% is after the IPO, and it's lagging the market this year. It's new, but this is one of those ETFs that has to have some shiny object performance, I think. And then people will go, oh yeah, of course this would go up. This is like the new IPO market. But it needs that performance first, I think. That's why I think it hasn't really found a lot of, it hasn't found a big audience yet.
Yeah. And this year, I mean, no road shows. It's kind of interesting that after IPOing, they still didn't get marketed that aggressively before IPO. So, you know, structurally, they may still get that distribution benefit spread out over a bit of time.
Comment on SPAC real quick. SPAC, Special Purpose Acquisition Company, the ETF is actually SPAK, if anyone out there is trying to look up this ETF and learn about it, which every time I go to look at it, I type in SPAC and it goes to a delisted company.
Thank you for that PSA.
Yeah, I like the GARP ETF mostly because I genuinely didn't even know it existed until Ethan brought it up when we had our pre-talk meeting about this. So, and I love the idea of growth light, just kind of looking at and seeing both the performance and whether or not advisors, retail investors put their money there. It'll be interesting to watch. And there's not many others that go after this GARP type strategy.
I also think it was interesting that he picked USMV. That's one that we've been talking about for years. It's a beast. What is it? $30 billion at this point. It's such an easy ETF to sell, right? Oh, hey, it's the market, but with a little less, you know, volatility or a little less edge.
And that sounds good.
It's like Diet Coke, and it basically flew off the shelves. The problem is it's trailing the market badly this year, and it shows that some of the people in there are fickle. Here's my question for both USMV and FDG, which is a theme I'm going to look into a lot more next year, which is, do you get a second bite at the apple? Remember currency hedged ETFs like really were on fire for a couple of years. They took in, I don't know what their peak asset was, maybe $60 billion. But then they started underperforming. And a large chunk of the people left. The assets went down because the market was down too. And they were a fraction of their old selves. Then they started outperforming again and nobody cared. Will USMV get a second look if it starts outperforming? We'll see. FDG's in the same boat. You've got all these ants. They all have names that you remember from the 90s. And it'd be curious to see if somebody goes, wow, this American Century Fund is really doing well. Or if they go, yeah, no, I've been there, done that. I'm going to look elsewhere to the next thing, you know, maybe like the new Goldman Smart Beta. Like, I just don't, I'm a little hesitant that you get a second bite of the apple. And so I'm a little bearish on the last two. But they're still interesting to watch. That has nothing to do with why they are good or bad picks. It's more just my take on their potential for assets in the future.
right, Eric, let's hear your five. Bring us home.
My first pick is the one that I'm the most excited to watch all next year, which is the DFAU. It's the Dimensional U.S. Core Equity Market ETF. This is Dimensional is a $370 billion active manager. It's one of our themes next year is big active, sort of like big pharma. It's all these big active shops are finally coming in full-heartedly in the next couple of years. And we just talked about ants. DFA is taking a different approach. They're going to put their ETF out with transparency. So they're not doing the ant approach. They're just going to let you see the holdings every day. And it's an active strategy. So they're going to, you know, pick stocks, although it's based on systemic quant methods that they do. And this is a firm seeing a lot of outflows. So, you know, can they turn it around? And now, to me, this ETF is like custom made for the advisor's brain. It's transparent. It's dirt cheap at 12 basis points. You've got a brand name like DFA, but at Vanguard fees, it's got low tracking. The top holdings are basically Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, only 21% market share. To me, they took the page out of Goldman's playbook when Goldman launched GSLC. And remember, we did the episode with Cole Feinberg? This is similar to that, and that worked. That has $10 billion. And the beauty of these strategies is they're kind of performance proof because the advisor is so scared of getting fired that they just want to pick stuff that has a good story but won't underperform. And this looks like it will not because it's so close to the S&P. And I think that's something you should see. Also, DFA is going to convert a bunch of mutual funds that equal $28 billion in assets. So, and that's also something that Wall Street banks like JP Morgan and Goldman did when they entered. They did a lot of BYOA and they look for opportunities to grow their assets quickly. So Goldman, JP Morgan skipped a lot of the sort of oblivion stage of a lot of legacy companies coming in late where they just hang in oblivion until they finally do something different. And they just ripped the Band-Aid off. And that's what DFA did. And I'm more bullish on them than the ants in terms of big active. But we'll see. The next one.
Speaking of active, yeah, next one.
Speaking of active, ARK, ARKK. We don't even need to spend that much time describing this. This is Cathie Wood's, you know, super, you know.
Ludicrous mode?
Yeah, she's in she's gone plaid. That's a deep Spaceballs reference. But yeah, she's on another level. I mean, ARKK, let me give you the numbers, up 500% since inception and 133% this year. That's triple the Qs, 8 times the S&P, and 2 times the Fidelity Growth Fund. Now, that Fidelity Growth Manager is tasked with the same thing, to pick growth stocks. So she's doubling a growth manager. That is how on fire she is. And she's inspired like about 30 copycat funds. So this will be one we watch for a long time. Here's the thing, though. As you all know here, I'm working on this book about Bogle. So I've been reading a bunch of his books. And it's hard, you know, when you read his books, he goes over the go-go eras from the 60s and the 70s. They happen like once every 15 years or a sell-off happens once every 15 years. And you realize there's funds like this in every era. And they end up getting a lot of assets. People say they're geniuses. And then a crash hits or a correction. And they usually go down more than the market. And people leave. And then they get back going again, but nobody cares. Or they can never get back to that. Again, it's the second bite of the apple. Is she a star here to stay or more like a comet? And that's something that we're going to find out.
Number 18.
SVAL. This is it's the opposite of Cathie Wood. This is the small cap value ETF from iShares. It's small cap value stocks. It's got a quant screen for liquidity, volatility, leverage, and analyst sentiment. So it's got a smart cap, a smart beta kind of filter. And then it ranks the highest scoring stocks, the top 250. Now, I like that it's concentrated. 250 means you're going to rip when it works. And that's what happened. When you look at the small cap value run that happened from basically since the vaccine from Pfizer was that news broke, for about 3 weeks, there was a huge rotation in the quote reopening trade. And this thing was up 21% during that time, more than the other small cap value ETFs, which hold more stocks. So they're going to be a little more anchored. So I think if you have a regime change where small cap value or small caps just, you know, has a 5 or 10 year run, this thing probably will be at the top of the list performance wise because of that concentration. It's also very cheap for a potential shiny object type ETF at 20 bips. Normally, you only see that pricing for the ones that are sort of more disguised beta. The other final note on this is, I don't know what's going to happen. We could have like the Qs have another amazing decade, but I just want to remind people that in the 2000s, that's the decade before this last one. If you look at the return, small cap value returned 7.5% annually that decade. The S&P returned nothing. And so in the 20 years since then, small cap value is still beating the S&P. That's how bad corrections are for the S&P. And it also just shows you that things do change. So again, I'm sort of looking forward to if and when there could be a regime change, look for SVAL. My other one is another one is MSOS. This is the Advisor Shares Pure Cannabis ETF. I work with Ken Shea, our cannabis analyst, a lot, and he has some great data showing that like legal cannabis sales in the US may hit $16 billion this year versus only $2.8 billion for Canada. Yet most of the exposure in the pot ETFs is in Canadian companies. The reason for that is because you're not really allowed to invest directly in what's called multi-state operators in the US. So this ETF uses swaps to sort of cleverly sidestep that rule. Long story short, it's basically 100% US exposure with 50% of that going to the MSOs. So that's the way more than any others. So these are companies like Green Thumb, Trulieve, Curaleaf. They're all significantly up. And if you look at MSOS versus MJ, it's up 43% since versus 30%. So again, not having those Canadian companies could really help this thing in the future. And then my final pick is boring, but beautiful. VTI. This is the Vanguard Total Market. To me, this is the perfect ETF. It's pretty much flawless. I have my opinion is this is the most likely to take over SPY as the biggest ETF in the next 5 or 10 years, even though IVV has more. This is the third biggest currently. But here's why I got to watch out for this one. The Tesla situation with the S&P, to me, I think it may have hurt the S&P 500 brand. I don't know. It's an amazing brand. It's rock star. Maybe it's just beyond that kind of stuff. But the idea that S&P, the S&P 500 is going to lag beta ETFs such as the Russell 1000 or the Bloomberg 500, I don't know. It could irk people. That Tesla not having it costed about 1% this year. Now, VTI invests in everything. So VTI has had Tesla for 10 years, basically, and Tesla's contributed 2.7% or 1% of its total return of 270%. So you don't have to worry about whether the new stock is in it or not, because it tracks small caps. I also like the fact that it's regime change proof. So we talked about small value. What if small value has like a 10-year run and the S&P lags? It won't really matter too much with VTI. You're going to have those stocks in there anyway. So to me, VTI reminds me of that line in the movie Almost Famous. Remember when the young journalist, the Rolling Stone journalist, talks to the sort of grizzled old like rock critic played by Philip Seymour Hoffman? And he says, yeah, my kids in the high school don't like me. And he goes, don't worry, you'll see them all again in the long road to the middle. And I just think VTI is the long road to the middle, whether it's value, growth, small, large. These things have their day, and then they're in the doghouse. VTI generally is going to be where they all end up, you know, over 30, 40 years. So to me, this is just like the ultimate play on the market, and it's something I'm watching next year and every year after.
James, what do you make of that marijuana pick?
So I like MSOS just because of basically what Eric said. I mean, if there's anything happening with U.S. legalization, whether it's federally or more states, those are the stocks that are going to benefit the most. I actually did some research on this and created like an index of just MS, like multi-state operators, some that are included in that ETF, some that aren't. And I mean, just since March, that thing, it's the market cap of all those companies is up 335%. So we're talking like massive growth. A lot of that's on the referendum from the election in November. A few states passed legalization in different matters. But if you're looking for legalization in the US and you're buying MJ, I mean, it's just too exposed to Canada to truly benefit. And one could argue that even legalization in the US might even be a bad thing for some of those Canadian companies, which we saw. Some of those Canadian pot companies or marijuana companies actually saw a negative impact. So definitely something to be watching going forward, especially in the US political landscape.
And Morgan, what about ARK?
Yeah.
That was like a no-brainer, right?
Yeah, pretty classic pick. But I mean, I think it'd be crazy to say we're not watching it next year. You know, I think they are a high conviction shop and they are full transparency. So we actually get to see what their high conviction choices are here. But, they're trying to blend or in this fund, they're sort of including all their innovation platforms. And so you really get a taste of kind of full range here. So always interesting to watch and see where their high conviction is.
Sarah Fagus, what do you make of the boss's pick?
Yeah, the DFAU one is interesting. Well, I don't think the product itself is that interesting. It's DFA pick I like. You know, they launched these few ETFs, then they did this massive conversion right behind it. So they're coming into the industry with a bullet. They're now going to be like the 11th biggest issuer in the market. So they came in very, very aggressively. So, and what we've seen is firms that have done this, the ones that really take it seriously and come in very aggressively are the ones that do tend to do a little bit better. So that's a really good pick, I think, to judge how DFA and frankly, how other active managers are going to follow.
Going back to ARK specifically, everyone likes to talk about ARK and Cathie Wood, but she has another product this year that's beating ARK, ARKK, by 40%. And everyone likes to talk about ARK as a bubble product. It's getting all of its benefit from Tesla. But ARKG doesn't hold Tesla. It's the Genomic Revolution ETF, which is another example of just how on fire Cathie Wood has been. The other thing is Tesla, it's the largest contributor to ARKK, but it's only contributed 17% of those returns since its inception. So it's not like it's solely a Tesla fund. They're making a lot of other high concentration bets, doing a lot of trading around their portfolio that's generating alpha for them. So you hear a lot of like financial media and Twitter talking about how bad these products are. But when you dive in, it's not really as concentrated or solely due to one or two stocks. It's they're getting a lot of breath from their performance.
Okay. Hey, Eric, I want to ask you, at Business Week, we do this thing called the jealousy list every year, which is we ask a ton of the editors and writers, photo design, etc. What was the one story that you were most jealous of that we did not publish? And I want to ask you, of all your team's picks, whose pick are you most jealous of that wasn't your own?
I'll go with ICVT, Morgan's pick. I actually just forgot it existed. I mean, every other one that was picked, I knew about. This is just one, you know, when it comes to like preferreds and convertibles and some of the stuff that's sort of a little on the more wonky side, these are ones that you sometimes forget about when you're constantly looking at, say, the aggregate bond ETFs or, you know, the high yield. And I like it. And I looked at it, it's over $1 billion. So it's a, you know, stud ETF, it's 20 bips. And yeah, I think it's great. And the returns were shocking. If you had asked me how much this was up this year, I would have been way off. So I just like that I was completely surprised by it. And I honestly just, you know, one of those ones you just don't even realize is there, to be honest. Which at $1 billion is probably not a good thing to say about myself as an analyst. I mean, I should probably have had that one in my mind, but I just didn't.
All right. So I'm no math wizard, but I do have a kindergartner that, you know, is doing Zoom kindergarten and we're doing a lot of math together. There's four of you. You each had five picks. That brings us to 20. How do we get to 21?
So we were thinking about that. And as we looked at our list, two things. One, we felt we had undersold fixed income a little bit. But then two, one of our big themes this year is in our outlook is fixed income. So we decided to pick LQD as one that we're watching next year.
So house pick, team pick.
Team pick. This is the cherry on top of what's already a large cake. Yeah.
And what is it again?
It's a iShares investment grade bond ETF. It's sort of become, as James put in his notes, sort of the new bond dealer, as there's less inventory at traditional bond dealers. People use this thing all the time for many different purposes. It's like a giant hotel with all kinds of people coming in and out of it. And this March sell-off, its volume exploded and people leaned on it and it worked. And then the Fed said they're going to buy ETFs and the one they own the most of is LQD. It was a wonderful endorsement for ETFs, I think. And the assets in this thing doubled from the March low of $28 billion. They're now at $57 billion. It's rare to get 100% asset growth in an ETF that's already massive. And so we're going to see what happens next year. This thing will be interesting. Will the Fed potentially look to equity ETFs? Will they start unloading their bond ETFs? Either way, we're very bullish fixed income.
This is one of those things where the Fed putting its money behind it. One, it was a lot of people trying to front run, but also it's kind of ended up like a snowball. As more trading happens, as more money comes into it, more and more people are going to start using it kind of as a bond dealer, as you mentioned. And the other, it just becomes more liquid, more institutional attention, and all of that kind of snowballs onto each other. So this is something we're watching to see how long that snowball can go on, and will it continue into 2021?
James, Morgan, Tom, thank you so much for joining us on Trillions.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for listening to Trillions. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you like to listen. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter. I'm at Joel Weber Show. He's at Eric Balchunas. You can find Morgan at mbarna6, James at jseph, and Athanasios at tserafagus. As always, good luck spelling that one. This episode of Trillions was produced by Magnus Hendrickson. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcasts.